testing is harder than developing. That if you want to do good testing, you need to put your best people in testing. Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, it's Joe, and welcome to the 100th episode of Test Talks. And what better way is there to celebrate a milestone than talking with a living legend, Gerald Weinberg. Jerry has been developing and testing for over 50 years and was one of the engineers who worked on the very first NASA American space program, Project Mercury, where Jerry designed and implemented the space tracking networking system, focusing on the first multi-programmed operating systems. He has written over 30 books, with some of my favorite being Weinberg on Writing, The Fieldstone Method, Perfect Software, and Other Illusions About Testing, and Becoming a Technical Leader. You don't want to miss this episode. It's like talking to a real Obi-Wan Kenobi or Yoda. Check it out. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Jerry, welcome to Test Talks.
Well, welcome to New Mexico.
It's an honor to have you on the show. You know, you have so many books out there, probably around 50, I think. But today, I think I'd like to focus on probably Perfect Software and Other Illusions About Testing, and probably touch on whatever other topics may come up.
Okay, fair enough.
Cool. So first, I guess I have to ask, how are you so productive as a developer and writer? What's the secret?
Well, I don't know if there's one secret. But maybe the secret is at a sort of meta level, is stop looking for secrets. Yep. And just figure out one little improvement at a time. You know, get rid of things that are using your time that are not productive and that you don't like to do. I mean, part of it is you have to love what you're doing. And if you don't love it, then it's pretty hard to bring yourself back to it. You know, writing, for instance, and writing code and so on is easy to postpone. So you really learn to love it. And when people tell me, oh, I hate writing, and you know, it's very hard for me, and I think, well, then maybe you're just not cut out to be a writer. You find a way to love it. Same way with testing, find a way to love it. And then you'll find, instead of excuses not to do it, you'll find excuses to do it.
Yeah, that's great advice. And it's actually, I started reading your Fieldstone Method, Weinberg on Writing. Mm-hmm. And that's actually one of the first things you say, if you need to love what you're writing. But also, I've been seeing lately, I don't know, this might be weird, but this Fieldstone Method is I've been applying to other areas of what I've been doing. For example, I started doing a video training course, and I was kind of struggling with it. But after reading this book, I was able to apply the principles here to the video training based on what my energy level was at a given time, and I don't have to follow a certain pattern. And it really, really was helpful. So I just highly recommend this book to anyone that's looking at how to write better or actually do anything in life better. I think the Fieldstone Method seems to be able to be applied to many things.
Well, it's kind of realistic. I mean, you take the world as it comes. I mean, we would like to be able to plan everything in advance and know exactly you want to do this on this day at this hour and this minute and so on. But the life doesn't work out that way. I mean, I was thinking about that yesterday. I had to go deposit some legal papers to the county courthouse. And I'm thinking, I've got to get there before they break for lunch. And I've allowed plenty of time. And everything, you know, great plan, everything is fine. And I get close, and there's a big sign that says detour on this road, and I can't get there. I have to go around the long way, and then, of course, I was late. But every day, stuff like that happens. So people who make really solid plans about things, and this is definitely applies to software testing. Right. You know, I mean, you're testing because you're trying to discover things. And when you discover something, then your plans change or ought to change. And if you just blast ahead with what you thought at the beginning, you're not doing very good job. So I guess that's the secret of being productive, or if there's a secret, is adapt to what is as opposed to what should be or whatever. And of course, another way to describe testing is that it's finding out what actually is as opposed to what's supposed to be. A program is supposed to work a certain way, and a tester finds out, well, it doesn't work in that way. And then you report that, and then somebody does something about it. And you live your life the same way, you'll be pretty productive.
What you just mentioned may not seem intuitive to most people. Most people think that testing is very structured and that you have to follow a set of procedures, but it almost sounds like you can't plan, just like you can't plan certain things in life, you may not necessarily be able to plan your testing effort perfectly. And that's okay. That's what testing is. It's exploring and finding things out. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Woody Allen said, and Yogi Berra said, and a number of other people said, is that I can predict anything except the future. And that's the problem. We'd love to be able to predict the future, we think. Although if you knew the day you were going to die, and so I don't know if that'd be good or not.
That's true.
But, and to some extent, we can predict the future quite a lot, so that we get the illusion that we can predict it all the time, and we can predict it very precisely. So you can predict it, and you can plan. Just be ready that your plan isn't working out. Then you make a revision of the plan, or you plan to replan. It's like all this business about the waterfall method of software development.
Right.
Well, there's a waterfall method in testing, too. And people have said bad things about the waterfall method, but waterfall method is great if you can do it, right? If it works, then it's great. You can do one thing after another, and don't run into any difficulties, then it's fine. That's the fastest way to get things done, and no anxiety or anything else. But as soon as something happens that you didn't plan on, then you have to drop that plan in favor of a new plan, which is what I'm going to do next. And it applies to development, it applies to testing, and it applies to life. Even though we would wish that we wouldn't have to do that, we think we'd like to be able to plan and everything goes according to plan. And that would be very nice. And sometimes it happens, and then it's very nice. I mean, I had arguments with people who are advocates or devotees of agile or adaptive programming. And they say, well, things always change. Well, maybe, not always. See, that's a prediction about the future too,
yep.
Right? And you're predicting that things will always change, and sometimes they don't change. So that prediction is wrong. I had a student who was in the business of converting COBOL programs into COBOL programs. You know, you'd come out with a different version of the compiler, a little different standard, and people have this huge investment in their COBOL programs. So he wrote software that did 99% of the job and then a little handwork, and the customers didn't want any changes. They wanted exactly what they had before, and he could give fixed price contracts, and he could work to schedule and deliver error-free code and so on. And so it can happen, all right? But to plan on that happening and not be ready to do that, that just isn't smart, that's all.
Absolutely, I totally agree. Another concept you go over besides this imperfect software and other illusions about testing is that risk, about product risk, and that a lot of people, when they're testing, if they're not thinking about risk, they probably may not be testing. Can you just explain what risk has to do with testing, and when someone's planning testing, how risk comes into play?
Yeah, I'll try. First thing you have to do, and I find that this is not done very well, is you have to ask yourself, whose risks are you concerned about?
Hmm.
For example, I make a piece of software, test it, and I deliver it to the world, and it doesn't work right, okay? So if it doesn't work right, what's it cost? Well, the question first is, who's it cost? As a developer, I might lose my job. I might have to spend a lot of time doing work over. As the company or organization behind the development, I might lose a client or a customer or lots of customers if I deliver software that doesn't work. So as a risk, I could go out of business if I deliver software that doesn't work. But then there's the risk to the users of the software, which can be way bigger. And I've worked on systems where if the system didn't work right, somebody died. Okay. Not the developer didn't die. The tester didn't die. So the risks to them were different. I mean, if you're a developer and you build some software and somebody dies because of it, well, you're still alive, right? So your risk isn't as great. You might get a bad reputation. You might lose your job. You might feel bad. Those are all risks for you, but your customer is dead. And that's a pretty big risk. I don't know how you put that on a money scale or anything. But and one of the problems we have in the industry with our testing is that the testers are, they're testing to get rid of risks for the developers or the company that's selling some software, as opposed to risk to the customers. And sometimes they have to do that. I give an example. I think it's in Perfect Software. My niece is a writer, and her first book, she used Microsoft Word. And when the book came out, she found out that every several hundred words, or maybe several thousand words, I don't remember, a word was just missing from the text. Right? And it was book was printed and many copies were printed, and they didn't notice it until after they were printed. Well, I happened to be consulting with Microsoft at the time, and I working with the Word people and some others, and I told them about this. I was visiting, and I said, look what happened. And they said, oh, yeah, we know about that. It's a bug. And a really large document, you're going to lose a word now and then. And I said, well, when are you going to fix it? And they said, well, we're not going to fix it. And I, you know, what do you mean you're not going to fix it? And they said, well, it only happens if you're doing something really big. And most people using Word, they're writing a letter or a memo or something, maybe a small article, and it never happens to them. It only happens. And we don't recommend that people develop a whole book on one Word document. And it's only there. So there might be 1,000 people in the world that are affected by this. And we've sold 100 million copies of Word. And the risk of trying to fix that is greater, that we're going to make a worse error somewhere else, and it's going to affect a lot more people. So it's just too bad for those 1,000 people. In other words, they're at risk, but it's no big risk to us because, okay, so we lose 1,000 customers out of 100 million. They're going to ask for a refund. That's fine, right? So, see, they were doing a risk assessment, and it comes out, it doesn't sound right, you know, when you hear somebody say, well, we know the errors are there, we're just going to leave them there, because the risk of trying to fix them is greater than the reward of fixing them. And that's very logical, right? It's very engineering, good engineering in a way, but we would like to believe that we could do otherwise, but we can't.
Absolutely. And so risk does come into play a lot. I actually work for a medical company, and we actually have certain software that if it doesn't behave correctly, we could kill someone. So we have to worry about the FDA. So I guess, how do you combat, though? The other extreme I deal with is we have managers that say, well, we'll just test everything. Yeah. And this is something that's been going on for years, this concept where you can't test everything. So how do you explain that to a manager or to an organization that where they really have legitimate risk, where they could do bodily harm to someone or actually cause death? How do you still say you can't test everything? How do you have that conversation, I guess?
I have clients who are in the medical business also. Some of them make medical devices, some of them that are internal to the body. Some of them make devices that are external. Some make medical test equipment that goes goes, say, in a doctor's office or in a hospital. And those who make equipment, they understand that you can't make a machine that's perfect. I think they understand that.
I hope so. Some of them don't. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, and they work to confine the risk as small as they can, but they look at what does it cost them if the device fails? Well, somebody, let's say you make something, a medical device that's implanted in somebody's body and one person dies. Well, okay, so they'll sue you and maybe they'll win $10 million. Well, that's a cost of doing business. It's like you have equipment in your office and your keyboard fails and you have to buy a new keyboard, right? So that risk is not very great and most people just live with it. But if somebody dies because your keyboard fails, then it's a much bigger risk. But again, you calculate and you do what you can to make the right decision. It's the best you can do. But if you think you can do it perfectly, that there will never be any risk of a failure, then you're just wrong. I mean, physics tells us that perpetual motion machines can't be built and so on. And you live with it. And we live with imperfection all the time. And some people get very upset by it, right? It's some places it's more important, some people it's less. But people who have a perfection rule, perfection need, that any little perfection bothers them as much as any big imperfection. And these people do not do a good job in testing. For example, one of the problems you get into is a tester who says, I have to test everything. And I have a manager telling you that. The tester feels they're never finished. Well, yes, you're never finished. It's just part of the business. Just like if you're a doctor, a surgeon, and once in a while somebody dies from the surgery that you do. This is a critical moment in your career, and you could say, well, somebody died, I'm going to stop being a doctor. You just have to get through that. I don't know what else to tell you. And to appeal to a manager who says test everything, you have to be ready with examples of what would involve to even come close to testing everything. We have a algorithm that we use. I used it for people want to build a piece of software or a machine that does a certain thing. And sometimes the problem they're trying to do is so big that we can't do it. And like the problem of testing everything. It's fascinating to know. I mean, Charles Babbage, you know who Babbage is, right?
He invented the computer.
Yeah.
Yep.
Over almost 200 years ago, it made a mechanical computer, a pretty simple one. And he demonstrated to people, and he wrote this up and this is documented, that you could have this machine turn out the numbers from 1 to 1,000,000 in succession, in sequence. And then it would do 1,000,001. And then the next number would be what? 1,000,002. I have 1,000,000 cases where it always gives a successive number. It's like the sun coming up in the morning. All right. And the next number is not 1,000,002. It's 1,000,003 or some other. And he demonstrated this. He showed people at work. We've known that for hundreds of years, that you, no matter how much you've observed and tested, you're never sure. And we have examples of that. For example, in the security business, somebody plants a time bomb in your software, yep. Right? And you can test and you can test and you can test. You can use it. I give examples in the book. I mean, one of my books, I kept track of typos for over 30 years. And then all of a sudden, somebody came up with a new one that nobody had found. And literally 1,000,000 people had read that book. So if you can't accept this, if your manager can't accept this and downgrade you because of that, you're working in the wrong place. You try to teach them if they don't get it. And then instead, you teach them to do risk assessment. Okay, we're going to allow an error to get through once in a while. What happens when that happens? Can we fix it? Can we compensate the people? Or if something irreversible happens, like somebody dies, can we live with that? If not, we have to get out of that business. That's just life.
I guess this concept of certainty, I just thought of this, could actually be kind of dangerous. The reason why I think of this, I was speaking to another guest where they said they had 100% of test coverage. And so management was saying this is going to be successful. They released it, and then no one bought the application. Mm-hmm. So they had, in theory, something that should have been successful based on that metric. But I don't know. I was just thinking of that, the certainty that you'll never have that certainty. When you do, if someone really thinks they're certain, it's probably could be dangerous if someone thinks that
definitely,
way.
Definitely. And and also, it could be funny if you're my skin doctor, removed a little growth from my skin a few years ago. And she said to me before she did it, I said, well, is this serious? And she says, oh, it's just minor surgery, she said. And I said, and what is minor surgery? He says, well, that's surgery done to anybody else. All right. Well, that concept is very important in the testing business. You know, who is going to suffer and can you live with it or not? I don't know. I have so many cases in mind of people who were so sure that there weren't any errors in their software, and something turns up. And because they were not prepared for the idea that something might go wrong, that's what caused the trouble. It's what I call the Titanic effect. You see in one of my books. See, the reason that the Titanic sank, and the reason it was a disaster, was that they believed it was a sink-proof ship. Right? If they go through the icebergs and they say, well, nothing can sink this ship, so we don't have to worry about hitting an iceberg or something bad. And so they were careless. That's the thing you have to watch out for. You always have to reserve a little bit of your mind, your emotions, for the idea that something could go wrong. Probably something will go wrong. Are you prepared to respond to that? This explains a lot of practices that we try to teach people. For example, why do you care if your software is maintainable? If you make it once and it's perfect, it doesn't have to be maintainable. but if it's not maintainable and something goes wrong, somebody goes in there to try to fix it and they can't figure it out. And then you have now a little problem becomes a huge problem. Yep. See, and for maintenance and all kinds of other stuff, this belief that you could do things perfectly is what gets you into trouble.
Absolutely. So besides risk as being an indicator what testers should focus on, are there any questions a tester can ask before testing to make sure that they're focusing on the right things?
I think that you need to, I like to do certain things. Like I need to just sit down and talk with the developers and ask them what went on, you know, what happened, what was interesting, and so on, in an informal way. And this gives you a lot of clues to where you might be having trouble. And of course, certain kinds of talking are very specific. So for instance, and I'm sure you know this, if you're talking to a developer and the developer says, well, one thing for sure is you don't have to test block X because that one really is solid. You're laughing, right? Why are you laughing?
You know, that's the first thing you should check for sure. Right.
And why is that? Because that developer has this confidence that's unjustifiable, right? Which means that they haven't really tested it very well themselves, right? And they don't know it very well. And the opposite thing is also true. When something goes wrong, and you're trying to pinpoint it, which is another part of the testing, you know there's something wrong, and you talk to the developer, and the developer says, well, I know that it's in block X. That's the place you don't have to look. Because they've been looking in block X, and they haven't found it. So that's the last place you want to bother to look, right? So you look where their finger is pointing, and you go somewhere else. Right? So those are the kinds of things that is just talking to the people involved. And you talk to the customers and you try, if you've got a working product, you try to get real people to sit down with it and just sit next to them and watch what they do. Don't tell them things. Just watch what they do. You can't, you know, talking to the developers is not sufficient, nearly sufficient, because you're testing not just for errors of the kind that the code does something bizarre. You're talking about whether, well, in the case you gave, nobody bought this stuff. Maybe it didn't have any, quote, bugs in it or errors in it, except it wasn't what the customer wanted.
Right.
Right? Alan Perlis once told me something, and I had trouble believing it at first, and I came to realize how wise it was. He said, there's no such thing as wrong program. There's only different programs. And I give an example, I think, in the book. We were doing some training. We talked about training. We were training computer operators when multi-programming, multitasking systems first came into use. If a system would crash and it's running 10 different programs, it's very hard to restart it correctly. And it's a real problem for the operators. So we were developing operator training, and we wanted to train them how to respond to crashes. So we tried to write a program that would crash the operating system at random times as a training program. And we couldn't do it. We couldn't make the operating system crash. And we tried. And then somebody said, well, actually, we have a program that crashes the operating system. The people in the physics department, this was at the university, the people in the physics department keep crashing the operating system on us. They've got some big Fortran program that does this. And so we went to them and we got a copy of this program and we used it to train operators. The physics department wanted to simulate a hydrogen molecule or something like that. And it never worked for that for them, but it worked perfectly for us, right? So did the program have a bug or not?
Huh.
Well, so you can't answer that question unless you know who's going to use it and what they're going to use it for. So you need to talk to, it's great. I'm just looking at your logo here, and it says test talks. Talking is a big thing. And of course, listening, really, for testers. They've got, good testers have to know how to talk, of course, because they have to present their results to people who don't want to believe it, right? Oh, there's something wrong with the thing that you produce. Oh, no, there isn't. You know, right? So you have to be able to be a convincing talker, but you have to be an even better listener, because you're testing to find out if what this thing does is what people really want. That's another reason why testers have to be involved in the development process right from the beginning, when they're starting to do requirements and doing market surveys and so on, because you have to know what it is you're trying to accomplish with this piece of software, or you can't test it. There was, I know a case I was going to cite for you years ago in IBM. There was IBM produced Fortran, which was going to solve all programming problems, of course, and it hasn't done it yet. But in Europe, they weren't too happy with Fortran because they had developed Algol, and that was kind of, they wanted Algol compilers for their computers, and IBM kept hearing that, but they wanted to push Fortran. So some guy in a Scandinavian country, I think it was Denmark, but I'm not sure anymore, developed an Algol compiler by himself and put it out there. And IBM said, okay, now we can tell people we have an Algol compiler, and so they'll buy our computers. And they gave him a huge monetary award for doing this. They gave him a small award, but after a year, it was almost error-free, and this was unknown in most, you know, software IBM produced. I got a lot of field reports of errors. But this one, there was, in its whole first year of operation, there was only one error report from the field. So then they gave him a much larger award. Well, the thing was, it turned out that the error was that the thing wouldn't install in the system. That was the only error. Of course it was the only error, because you couldn't run the thing.
Oh, that's funny.
All right. So that's the first level of the story is you can't just count errors, right? On the other hand, if you think more deeply about it, IBM actually got what they wanted. They could, because they could say they had an Algol compiler, and so people bought their computers, and IBM actually believed it, right? So, I mean, they weren't lying to their customers. They said, we have an Algol compiler. And it turned out that none of the customers actually cared that much about an Algol compiler. And they tried it. It didn't install. So they went ahead and used Fortran. So was this program wrong or was it right?
That's a great story. It reminds me of metrics for some reason. You know, if you mm-hmm. have a metric, a bad metric, and people fulfill that, then like no bugs. Yeah, it has no bugs. Yeah. So we're successful.
Oh, yeah. IBM used to make the old IBM 650. They used to say it had never made an undetected error. I mean, what does that mean? Yeah, my favorite metrics thing out here in New Mexico, when I get a student come here from Seattle, for example, and they're enjoying the beautiful weather we have, and I'll say, well, you know, thing is, New Mexico is much cloudier than Seattle. And they say, what? What are you talking about? You know, look at the sun is shining. I said, well, no. I mean, look out. Let's go look at the sky and let's see. How many clouds do you see? Oh, there's one. Oh, there's another one. Oh, yeah, there's a third one. Yeah. Oh, there's five clouds. And how many clouds are there in Seattle? One. Covers the whole sky. So that's a metric, right?
Yep, absolutely. That's awesome. So you were the architect for the Mercury Project Space Tracking Network. You know, that was a few years ago. Is there anything in testing you think is still misunderstood that you can't believe it's still misunderstood by developers and testers?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know if there's something that's misunderstood by all developers and testers, but many, yep. many, maybe the great majority of them. See, we made the first separate testing group that I know of historically. I've never found another for that Mercury project, because we knew astronauts could die if we had errors, right? And they stuck out in space, not only die, but die slowly while they ran out of oxygen because we couldn't bring them back, right? And that's very bad publicity for IBM when 2 billion people are watching this space launch, and they're saying, well, the poor guy is going to die in a few days gradually as he runs out of oxygen. And that's because of a bug in the IBM computer. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of advertising you want, right? So whether we cared about their lives or not, I don't know. I cared, and I think most of our people cared. But even as a business decision, we couldn't afford, just like in your medical business, right? We can't afford to have people dying. It's bad for us. So we took our best developers, and we made them into a group. His job was to see that that didn't happen, right? And they built test tools and all kinds of procedures and went through all kinds of thinking and so on. And the record over a half a century shows that they were able to achieve a higher level of perfection, but it wasn't quite perfect than had ever been achieved before or since. And so we got a number of other places in IBM, a lot of places in the federal division, adopted our tools, adopted our approaches, and so on. And other people came from the outside, and we showed them what we did, and we taught them. And I kind of faded out of the testing business for a few years. And when I came back, I found that lots of people had set up separate testing groups, and I thought, that's great. You know, our message is getting out, and things are getting better everywhere. And it was a few more years before I woke up to a fact. All right, now, the reason was that I missed this was that I only get, as a consultant, I only get either the top places or the bottom places. Most people are developing software are just kind of average, and they would not pay to have someone come in to advise them, to consult with them. They think they know what they're doing, right? The top people know that they don't know what they're doing.
Yep.
Right? And they hire consultants. So I worked with the best companies in the world, and we were able to improve what they were doing. I also got to work with the worst ones because there were lawsuits. Somebody was suing them. Many people were suing them, and I get called in as an expert witness or try to salvage some terrible thing. So I had a really biased look at what was going on in the testing business, and all these middle people I wasn't seeing. And I just heard, well, they have testing groups now, so they've learned. No, that wasn't true. What they learned was they thought we could hire people to do testing cheaper than we could hire developers. See, because in my early days, developers tested their own stuff. We did pair programming, we reviewed our stuff and so on, but it was all developers. There was nobody with the title of tester. Now we had people with that title and managers who believed you could hire monkeys to bang on keys, and that's how you tested programs. So we've been through 40 or 50 years of that thing that people still don't know. People in the middle still do not know. Even if you have a test group, the test group code is better than the system code.
Exactly.
I mean, it's usually, if you'd ask again, that goes back to talking and just listening to when they talk. Generally speaking, self-developed test code or even the test cases is done carelessly,
right,
compared with the way, even the poor way that they might develop the software. They don't pay attention. They don't review their test plans, their test cases, their test procedures, their test tools. And why would you think, you know, that your testing is better, is good enough to test with, when it isn't, it itself is not tested, right?
Exactly. So that's another point you bring up in your book, and that is, do you think test automation can replace a real tester? What are your thoughts around test automation?
Well, I think test automation, and you guys, at first blush, you might not like me hear me say this because you're in that business, but it's another example of what the anthropologists call name magic.
Hmm.
Name magic. You know, I quote often, Abraham Lincoln had this riddle. It says, if you call a tail a leg, how many legs does a dog have? And what's the answer to that? Well, some people will say five. And Lincoln would say, no, calling it a leg doesn't make it a leg. So calling it automation, calling it test, doesn't make it test automation. It's just a label. It sells well and so on. To do successful test automation, there's so much other stuff surrounding it. You may have tools that automate certain tests, which is what I think you guys deal with.
Yep.
All right. But it doesn't automate testing. How do I say this? Suppose, for example, you're talking about baseball, and somebody says, we have an automatic batter, but they call it automatic baseball. Well, there's more to baseball than batting. There's running, and there's catching, and there's throwing, and so on, and there's knowing the rules. So by naming it something doesn't make it something. Naming it automatic baseball does not make it automatic baseball, right? So I think that I see a lot of clients who get in trouble. Some manager thinks, okay, I can buy this thing that's called test automation tool, and now I don't need testers. I just need one guy to press buttons or something, and it'll automatically test everything. Well, no, that isn't the way it works. And you guys know that, of course. And I imagine, you know, people who sell test automation tools get really frustrated by this because somebody buys a tool, then they complain, well, it didn't work. What it really means is they didn't work, right? They didn't use it properly. They didn't use it in the right cases. They tried to use it in cases where it didn't apply. So you can automate tasks that are involved in testing, and maybe many tasks, and save yourself a lot of effort and do things very reliably. And that's great, but it doesn't do the whole job.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with this wording. I think I don't know if you've heard of Richard Bradshaw, but he uses automation in testing rather than test automation to put the emphasis on it's helping you to do some aspect of testing, but it's not necessarily testing. It's checking, in that testing is much more than just validating something automatically. There's thinking involved and a lot of other things that go on in it. So using a different word almost is like a mind shift.
Great. I hadn't heard his expression. That's a great thing. Just adding that word in.
Yeah.
It could be very helpful. And which also is an example of how the tiny change can make an enormous difference.
Right. Okay, Jerry, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their testing efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
Well, there's probably, for each person, there's one way, but it'd be a different way for different people. For example, I have, okay, now here, this is a commercial message, okay, and you can edit this out if you, but I have written a number of books that help people in doing a better job of testing, but they're on different subjects because, as we just talked about, testing has many different things that have to be done in testing. You have to find the thing for yourself. So at a meta level, the one thing you need to do to become a better tester is to discover the one thing you need to do to become a better tester. Okay, and that sounds silly, but think about it. It's true. So that's your first task. And unfortunately, people tend to do the opposite, right? I don't know if you work out in a gym or you ever worked out in a gym or not.
Yep.
But if you go to a gym and there, you might see bodybuilders there, right? And one of the things that you notice about bodybuilders, they want to win some bodybuilding competition. And they've been told, you have great biceps. And you see these guys, they have great biceps, and in the gym, they spend most of their time developing their biceps, which is why they have great biceps. But they get into a competition and they get a good score on biceps, and they've got skinny little calves, and so they never win. And what they should be doing is looking at the worst part of their body from, bodybuilding point of view. And that's what they should be working on. It's spending most of their time, not the only thing, but that should. It's the same way in testing. So, for example, I've met many testers who do a beautiful job of detecting and isolating errors in code. Okay. And the way they talk to their customers, that is to the developer and their managers, is so offensive or so unclear that they're not successful testers. Those people need to study and practice and learn how to talk to people so they'll be listened to and they'll be believed, right? Or in some, talk pretty good, but if they write up an error report, it's just not clear. In English or whatever language they're using, those people need to work on their writing. They're those people who are not good problem solvers and they tend to overlook certain things. They need to work on their problem solving skills. See, all these things and some others are things that I've written books about. And I put together what I call a tester's library, which is a collection, a bundle of my books, as ebook form, at a nice price, a nice discounted price, to try to get testers who want to improve themselves to get the whole set and look and say, and this isn't everything. I don't cover it, but it covers a lot of different things. It covers writing, covers talking and feedback, covers problem solving, problem definition, and so on. And leadership, those are all things that a good tester needs to work on. The little trick I give people is that when you find yourself saying, instead, well, that's one thing I don't need to know about, then stop, catch yourself, and go learn about that. Because it's exactly like the finger pointing we talked about before. right? When the developer says, well, that's a module you don't need to look at. That's the one you look at first. And so you do the same thing yourself. Say, well, that's a skill I don't need. It has nothing to do with testing. And then it does. And you better work on it. I have two websites. My principal website is GeraldMWeinberg.com. And there's links there so you can get to me and all my books. And then I have a separate website because I write fiction. It's called womenofpower.org.
Thank you, Jerry, for your lifelong testing awesomeness. To link to everything of value that we went over in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/100. And while you're there, make sure to click on the sign up now free button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. And if this episode has helped you in any way, why not share it with a friend or coworker and help celebrate the 100th episode of Test Talks? Send them on over to testtalks.com and have them click on one of the free links to get the free Test Talks app for Android and iOS devices. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.